This episode is brought to you in partnership with Nestlé Carnation. Carnation has been delivering sweet and creamy deliciousness to desserts nationwide for over 120 years. Whether you're making or baking, topping or mixing, their products make desserts easier than ever. Incredibly simple and quick to use. You can make so many amazing treats with Carnation, from cheesecakes to banoffee pie, fudge, caramel, and toffee. A staple ingredient in every keen cook's cupboard. Head to their website, www.carnation.co.uk, for lots more inspiration, and there's even a free downloadable recipe book waiting for you there too. Thank you very much to Nestlé Carnation. Hi, I'm Margie Nomura, and welcome to the Desert Island Dishes podcast. This is the podcast where every week I ask my guests to choose their seven desert island dishes. These range from finding out about the dish that most reminds them of their childhood, the best dish they've ever eaten, and of course, the last dish they would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island. The question is, what would you choose as your last meal? Hi, I hope you're all very well. We went to Devon over half term and we went to the beach house in Thurlaston for the second time. And I have to tell you, I really do think it's one of my all-time favourite restaurants. It's just my favourite kind of food, the freshest ingredients, very simply prepared, and it's just so good. It was pouring with rain, of course, but being by the beach, being cozy inside, looking out over the sea and eating bowls of steaming mussels and delicious fish stew and amazing chips. It was just, I think, one of the happiest moments of recent weeks for me. They have no idea who I am, I can assure you, and it definitely wasn't gifted or anything like that. But I just wanted to share a little restaurant recommendation with you. I think we're going to start doing these on the website, and I'm hoping that's going to be a really useful, interesting, and fun new section of the website. I'd love to know about your recent favourite places, so do get in touch and let me know where I should be going. And don't forget, you can sign up for the newsletter, Dinner Tonight. You can do that via the website, desertislanddishes.co. And you guys, there are now over 11,000 of you on the newsletter list, which is so incredibly exciting. It's currently one delicious, easy weeknight recipe delivered to your inbox every Sunday. But I really do have big plans for this, so stay tuned, sign up, and good things are coming. This is a very fun episode for you today with the very funny Ed Gamble. I'm sure lots of you are familiar with his podcast, The Juggernaut, that is Off Menu. And his new book is out today, which officially makes him an author, something I know he is very excited about. It's obviously very funny. Ed is a comedian. But it also touches on themes we don't often hear men discuss. And I found it really interesting. Some of these themes we touch on in today's episode. So without further ado, here are Ed Gamble's Desert Island Dishes. My guest today is Ed Gamble. Ed is a comedian, an actor, host of the Off Menu podcast, amongst others, and judge on the Great British Menu. He can now also add author to his bio of credentials as his debut book, Glutton, is about to be released. His career in comedy began at Durham University, performing with the Durham Review before heading to the Edinburgh Fringe for the first time in 2011. His stand-up comedy is largely observational comedy, often aimed at himself, including discussion of his diabetes, which he was diagnosed with as a teenager. He says his humour was honed by a fixation with all things sitcoms and stand-up. Ed has been a regular panellist on the BBC panel show Mock the Week, has acted for shows on the BBC and hosted several radio shows. The Off Menu podcast, which he hosts with James Acaster, has been a phenomenal success, which has seen him become somewhat of a household name. When asked what made him get into comedy, Ed replied, "The perfect mix of a terrifying ego and an astonishing lack of self-esteem. I can't tell day to day whether I'm arrogant or I hate myself, but I think somewhere in between is absolutely ideal for a comedian. Welcome, Ed.
Well, thank you. Is that awful, having to read out things about people while they sit here looking at you?
I feel like I'm at school and I'm 8 years old and I make so many mistakes. It's terrible. But once that bit's over, I feel like I get into my rhythm. But I wanted to ask you about that quote, the perfect mix of a terrifying ego and an astonishing lack of self-esteem, because that's quite a contradiction.
Yeah, I think so. But I think most comedians you meet will have that contradiction within themselves.
Okay.
Also, I think starting young as a comic means that you have maybe a lack of self-awareness and confidence that youth brings.
Yeah.
But then also you need a remarkable amount of self-awareness and lack of confidence to be able to talk about yourself.
And to get on stage.
Exactly. Yeah, I think so. I think you have to have an ego, but also sort of no preoccupations with how you look, because you've got to go on stage and act like an idiot.
What do you think about comics who start later in life? Because you don't have that like naivety.
Well, I think a lot of comics who start in later life are often better quicker because they've got less time. So they've got so much going on in their lives. They're a lot better at writing and sort of focusing. And they know themselves better as well. I think when you start young, there's a period of a few years where you're writing jokes and trying to work out who you are or the sort of person you're putting across on stage, where, as I guess, if you start when you're a bit older, you've been through a lot more. So you can be like, well, I know what guy I am. Let's just walk up and see what happens.
Yeah, that's true. I guess in a way, maybe what you did starting young is scarier because you are figuring out who you are kind of in front of everyone else.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it was. I mean, a lot of people say, oh, it takes a lot of courage to get up and do what you do. It doesn't at all anymore. Like, I mean, maybe the first three, I was like a bit nervous, but I was doing it at university, like in front of my mates as well. So
what, you never found it scary?
Not really. If it's like a big gig, I still get those nerves and butterflies, but also I think I've burnt out all my adrenal glands or whatever it is now. They're all gone.
A very useful thing.
Yeah. I mean, adrenaline is there for a reason, right? You know, if it now
who cares just, about fight or flight?
Crossing a busy road completely dead behind the eyes.
I like to be very prepared on this podcast. I Googled the term glutton, which is the name of your book, and obviously it means an excessively greedy eater. But did you also know it's the old-fashioned term for Wolverine?
No, I didn't, but that's cool as hell.
I know.
I'm so into that.
Pretty cool.
I thought you were going to tell me it was some like ancient like slur or something, and I should have Googled it myself.
Turns out the
title of my book is hugely cancelable.
And that's the end of this interview. So your passion for food started very early in life. So we're going to dive straight into the first Desert Island dish. And that's the dish that most reminds you of your childhood.
So my mum cooked a lot when I was a kid. And I think my love of food doesn't necessarily come from her being like, oh, why don't you try this? I think I was sort of dedicated to being more of a gourmand than the other children.
Okay.
I think I saw kids complaining and I was like, no, that I'm going to be the one who eats everything.
Okay.
But she was willing to satisfy that by cooking like grown-up stuff for me. But I tell you, this is my grandma's dish that reminds me most of my childhood, and it's pretty bog standard. It's lasagna.
There's nothing wrong with that,
though. And today, having eaten the amount of stuff that I've eaten on Great British Menu and at restaurants everywhere around the world, absolutely obsessed with food, lasagna is still, I think, objectively the best food.
Mm.
It's meat cake, you know?
What a lovely way of describing
it. It's mince vianetta. It combines all of the best foods into one fantastically warming dish.
Yeah. So was hers actually the best? Or
no, my lasagna is the best, actually.
Okay.
My lasagna is the best.
Better than grandma's?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, she's no longer with us, so I can say that without feeling bad.
God rest her soul.
She was really good at a lot of other stuff. She did the best versions of other stuff. But I just remember I just gobble down portion after portion of that.
And this love of food that you describe in the book, I mean, it started as soon as you were able to eat, so sort of like, you know, several months old. Do you have siblings?
I've got a half-brother and half-sister, but they're, like, younger than me.
Okay, so do they have the same approach to food?
No. My half-brother does a bit, but nowhere near the level of me and my dad. And my sister is like, she likes food, but She would rather not go and gorge like the male members of the Gamble family.
Because it's interesting to think about like the nature versus nurture side of things.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't, as you've said, like it wasn't that your mum encouraged this necessarily. It was just something that was within you, this true passion for food.
Absolutely. And so my dad wasn't living with us from about the age of four, I guess. I was four. My dad wasn't four when he moved out. But we're a lot more comparable in terms of our food consumption. So I think it is definitely nature rather than nurture.
Okay. And you describe yourself as a pint-sized Jay Rayner, yes, as a baby, who despised children's menus out of the sheer injustice of the concept. So talk to me about the kids' menu and your feelings towards it.
Well, it played into that thing of like, why should I be given something different? Why can't I play with the grown-ups, you know? And also they're just so... the kids' menus are so disappointing. It's all... oven chips and chicken nuggets. Now, I actually think if I went to a restaurant for grown-ups and they were like, our concept is we're doing like kids' menus for adults, I'd be like, yeah, give it to me. Absolutely.
Also maybe, because when I was reading about that, I thought maybe actually they exist for the grown-ups because there's nothing more fun than eating that's the food that you want to eat in a restaurant, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then the children are there and it's just an excuse to have fish and chips.
I think as a kid, I was like, well, no, I'm a grown-up. I can't possibly be eating the stuff that all these little kids are eating, even though I was like six. But now I'd love it. And, you know, get a crayon and colour in the table mat. I'd have a great time.
But did that desire to... almost be a bit more grown up than you were, was that only to do with food? Or as a child, were you quite ready to be a grown up?
No, I was very badly behaved. So I think it was genuinely only food because I was, you know, I was running around and being more badly behaved than the rest of the kids.
You weren't like a 40-year-old, 4-year-old.
Only in the way I ate, absolutely.
Okay. Let's move on to the second desert island dish. What was the first dish you learned to cook?
So I think it was an Usborne book of like recipes for kids specifically to be like the first things you're going to cook. And there was a recipe in there. There was like spag bol and things like that. But the first thing I distinctly remember cooking from that is the chocolate brownie recipe. Ooh. From there. And I remember the book, not because it stuck in my head so distinctly, but because I think I cooked those brownies maybe about 5 years ago.
Oh,
that
really?
Book is still at my mum's house. Actually, maybe slightly more than that. It was when I was still living at my mum's house and I just met my girlfriend who then became my wife, and I cooked her those brownies.
Was that what sealed the deal?
I think it must have done. Yeah.
What makes them so good?
They're very easy.
Okay.
That's all it is. It's a recipe for kids.
And so with being given a cookery book as a child, was it assumed that because you loved food and you enjoyed eating that you would therefore enjoy learning to cook? Or was that something that you wanted to do?
I don't think it was assumed. I think I wanted to do it. I still love cooking. I just don't have any time to do it. So I will read cookbooks like... their novels, and then absolutely use them for no practical purpose whatsoever.
I think that's quite common.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the size of cookbooks that come out, there's like 250 recipes in there and something, and a full autobiographical reason for every recipe. I think they know that people aren't really using them.
Yeah, it's not a practical way to cook, however beautiful and amazing the recipes are. It's just quite a big effort to pull it off the shelf, and I don't know. It's
also,
just...
they all, most cookbooks I have need spices I don't have. So then you go and buy 800 different spices, put them on the shelf, use them once, and then have to throw them out in 3 years' time. So it's not practical, but I do like reading them and looking at the pictures.
We all like that. So you say you love to cook. As a judge, how would you rate your level of cooking?
I'd say sort of homely. Not gourmet, not high end. I don't see the point in doing that sort of level of presentation at home. You know, who's looking?
Ed, you are.
Yeah, I am, but I don't care, do I? I've eaten most of it while I was stood up cooking it.
I know, that's always the thing, isn't it? By the time you actually sit down, there's nothing left.
Yeah.
Do you think it's possible to be really passionate about food and not enjoy cooking?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think
so? Yeah, I think so. Well, it's difficult. I think you can really appreciate food and you can appreciate amazing restaurant food without cooking, as long as you don't start going to restaurants and going, oh, no, I don't think this is very good. Yeah. I don't think you can be negative at all. It's like, right, well, if you don't do it and you don't understand how to prepare a dish, you can't be negative about it.
Do you think that's true?
Yeah.
So with restaurant critics and stuff, they need to have an understanding of how it was actually made. Or is it just an appreciation? Like, is eating a very different thing?
I think it's an appreciation of technique and appreciation of the amount of work it takes. And I think most good restaurant critics do have that.
Yeah. They say to be a really great cook or chef, you have to be a great eater. It's like training your taste buds.
Yeah, so but I guess some of them, you see, they're all, you know, lithe and nippy and, you know, they're running to work and stuff. That's unacceptable,
I think. Like an occasional taste.
Don't trust it.
That is the saying, isn't it?
That's where you need to go to the people who the chefs go and, go and get food from.
Yes.
It's like haircuts.
Although that's not always true, because lots of restaurant chefs will go and get a McDonald's at the end of the night. Yeah. And I'm not saying anything about McDonald's.
No, of course.
But it's not Michelin star, is it?
Yeah, I think they have a similar sort of potential diet than a lot of comedians, I think.
It's funny to think how life turns out, as you now obviously have a podcast about food and you're a judge on the Great British Menu, which is a huge and prestigious job in the world of food.
Well, it was before I took it over. I'm bringing down the reputation of it somewhat.
Little by little.
Yeah.
Would you ever have thought that you would end up having a career in food?
Not at all, but I think that's a good thing. And that's something I tell like new comedians is talk about what you enjoy. Because A, you're going to be better at talking about that and it's really going to come across. And people in the television industry and entertainment industry, for some reason, think comedians can do anything.
Okay.
So even though we all get into it just to do stand-up, people end up going, well, maybe you should try acting in this. Maybe you should write a book. Maybe you want to come and be a judge on a food show, even though we're not qualified for anything. That's the point. So if you start really talking about what you're passionate about, I think people really enjoy that. And it's a connection to who you are as a person. So I can see why it's happened, but that was never my aim. I was just, you know, talking about what I could.
Yeah, it's an amazing turn of events. But I think that goes back to the previous point about you saying you don't have to be very brave to do what you do. But I think that isn't the general opinion. Like, most people are terrified to stand up on a stage in front of thousands of people. And so the fact that you can do that seemingly so effortlessly does make people just think, oh, well...
Yeah, I see what you mean. But I mean, from my perspective, I'm not being brave at all.
Okay.
Literally just gobby. So I've used that to make money somehow.
Okay, well, that's very modest. Let's talk about the third desert island dish. What's the best dish you've ever eaten?
See, this one's really hard. Because what happens is I'll eat something and I'll go, that's the best thing I've ever eaten. And then the day after I'll eat something and go, that's the best thing I've ever eaten.
Maybe the next one is the best thing you've ever eaten. It just keeps getting trumped. Or do you think you forget about previous ones that were the best?
I think it just washes away the memory. And there's so much involved, isn't there, in a dish that you think that's the best thing I've ever eaten. It's so much about surroundings and who you're with. And
how hungry you are.
How hungry you are, exactly. And that's not necessarily you have to be really hungry. There's a midpoint.
Yeah.
If I'm hangry and I eat something, I'm not even tasting it. It's just going straight down. I tell you what, I'll tell you the best thing I've eaten recently, which at the time I thought, that's the best thing I've ever eaten. And it's going to sound horrible.
Okay.
On the menu, it was just called tripe.
Oh, okay.
But let me tell you, this thing was incredible. So it was at Mountain, which is a new restaurant from Thomas Parry, who runs Brat as well. He's a fantastic chef. And it's an amazing menu, and everything was great, but we just ordered tripe. There was no other description for it. But it was what you would imagine. It was like sort of slow-cooked tripe with all the gizzards and innards and stuff in this amazingly rich tomato sauce, and I think there was bits of chorizo in there as well. It was incredible. That tends to be the things I end up remembering and enjoying the most, the things that feel like there's more love in them, that they've taken a long time to cook, that... I love fine dining and I like tasting menus and I like the sort of ritual of it, but I never remember the little dishes that they bring you, you know, with a little flour on top. I'm never going, that's the best thing I've ever eaten. It has to be substantial. It has to feel warming.
Yeah. Would you ever choose a pudding as the best thing you've ever eaten?
No, I don't think so. I do enjoy desserts. Mm.
We've only ever had that once that someone's chosen. Yeah, isn't that interesting?
Interesting, yeah. I mean, I tend to think that if you go out to a restaurant and you've got room for pudding, then you've not done a good enough job on the starter or main course.
But it's a different stomach.
It is a different stomach, but also I think I fill up the other stomach so much that they're impinging.
Your grandmother was a brilliant cook, and in the book you say that restaurants are missing a trick, because if there was a restaurant run by grannies cooking hearty, simple food, it would be fully booked night after night. And I thought that was so interesting because I had that exact conversation with a guest last week, and it's so true. Why does that restaurant not exist?
Well, I think also in the book, I think I point out some of the logistical flaws with it, in that it would have to shut quite early for early bedtimes.
Yeah.
You'd need a big staff.
No, we could get them on a different timetable.
Yes. Yeah. I think it needs to be on, but there would have to be, I think, thousands of
grannies thousands employed. Of grannies.
Yeah. Which is, I mean, look, some of them are looking to keep busy, right? Mm-hmm. I follow an Instagram account called Pasta Grannies, which
the
is, yeah, with the, yeah, Italian grandmas making pasta. And yeah. I just think that's it. He just, that's the sort of restaurant I want to go to.
Yeah. I was going to say, I think restaurants run by grannies, as with Pasta Grannies, it's more common somewhere like Italy where you get a little trattoria and it's run by the nonna. But I feel like we're missing out in Britain.
And then at the end of the meal, you can go to the kitchen and they'll probably give you a pound.
If you're very lucky. We're on to the most important question of the day, the fourth desert island dish. Ed, what is your favourite sandwich?
This is tricky. I've thought about this a lot. Now, I'd say the sandwich that I don't get to have very often, but I absolutely love it, is whenever I go to Montreal, or when I, these are similar sort of sandwich, whenever I go to New York, I love a pastrami Reuben in New York from Katz's Deli.
Yeah.
And it's really sort of touristy and it's the go-to, but it is absolutely incredible. And in a similar vein, I really like, they call it a smoked meat sandwich from Schwartz's Deli in Montreal. So it's within the pastrami realms. It's like Jewish deli meat, basically.
But which is better if you had to pick between those two?
I'd probably go for... See, I really like Schwartz's because whenever I've been to Montreal, I literally get off the plane and go straight there and it's like... Hello, I've arrived. And what I really like as well is there's always a massive queue, but I never tell anyone else I'm going and always go by myself. So I just go to the front of the queue and go, it's only me. And they go, right, okay, come and sit at the bar.
I thought you were going to say, do you know who I am?
No,
I'm Ed
God,
Gamble.
No.
I need a sandwich.
Would not, they couldn't care less. They would not know. But if you're by yourself, then you can just squeeze in at the bar. And it's great.
That is a top tip.
But I think I will go for the pastrami Reuben from Katz's because it's still an exciting place to go. And it's massive.
Mm. But Katz's is an interesting place because it is a tourist attraction, obviously, because everyone talks about it so much. But I feel like it is also loved by locals.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So it's quite, it's a mixture of
It's maintained
two.
Its quality, for sure.
And which is quite amazing, given... Yeah.
Given it's huge and, you know, Harry Met Sally and all of that stuff, and it's so busy. But I also love the way the place works. I'm a sucker for watching a slick operation. Taking the ticket, going in, ordering what you want. They write what you've had on the ticket, and then you pay on the way out. Mm. Bang, 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 out. And you've had like a 9,000 calorie sandwich and you're set up for the day.
It's quite bear-esque, isn't it?
Like yeah. Oh, yeah.
That kind of thing.
I love the bear.
So good. In the book, you talk about your relationship with food and the impact that that relationship had on your body and how you've been in a larger body and you've also lost a lot of weight. You talk about the different roles you played throughout your life and you say at school you were happy to be, in your words, the funny fat guy and later at university, the fully formed funny fat fresher. And it struck me that with both of those descriptions, you've always been... the funny guy. Do you think your funniness was something that you developed because of your size?
Yeah.
Were those two things interlinked?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not saying that if I was sort of skinnier when I was a kid that I wouldn't have been funny. I think that was natural and I liked entertaining people, but I think I really, really lent into that because of my size. Like thinking, well, that's what I'm going to bring to this group then. I can't be the sort of, you know, A-team rugby player. I can't walk around like all those, you know, good-looking people at school and university just, you know, existing on their laurels. So I'm going to be funny. And also that's such an important social role, I think.
Mm.
I think I must have instinctively known that. Every group needs someone funny, right?
Definitely. Yeah. But I just wondered, you obviously are naturally funny, but maybe if things had been different, you would have just been, you know, the slightly funny guy.
Maybe.
I wonder whether life would have turned out the same way.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't think it would have done. Absolutely not. But I think we can say that about anything, right? Mm. You know, if things weren't exactly as they were in the past, what would have changed? But no, I'm not sure I'd be a comedian now if I wasn't the sort of fat, funny guy at school.
And you started doing comedy when you were at Durham before later going to the Edinburgh Fringe just a few years later. You've said that while you're at university, you didn't know what you wanted to do. Was comedy something that you thought about pursuing seriously, or what did you think you were going to end up doing?
Well, I pursued it very seriously when I was at university, even though I should have been pursuing my course very seriously. Like, we were dedicated to it. Like, it was me and Nish Kumar and Tom Neenan, Pete Riley, and we just used to write sketches all day and rehearse all day and just completely ignore our academic stuff. So I think probably in the back of my mind then maybe I was thinking, I need to keep this up when I leave. But you can't really say I'm going to be a professional comedian when I leave university because it's so impossible to make money from it for years. But I had no other plan in my head to be like, well, I'll do this to make money and then I'll do comedy. It was sort of all in, really.
Mm.
Yeah.
Saying that you want to be a stand-up comic is kind of like saying you want to be a Hollywood actor. Like lots of people would like to do that, but it's seeing how that can actually play out in your life. At that moment when you were at university thinking about the future, what would you have thought would be a success? Like, what is a successful stand-up comic as you're at university?
I think just making any money from it.
Okay.
So, but I had no concept of how much humans need to make to survive, to be honest. I was just like living in a complete dream world. So I always said when I actually probably quite soon after I came out of uni, when I started doing comedy and turned professional after, you know, 2 or 3 years.
And what does that mean?
As in all my income was coming from, from comedy. But then also do bear in mind, my mum lives in London and I was living in her house. So it's difficult to say I was, you know, fully earning my keep. Very lucky to be supported in that way. But I think I had an idea. I started supporting Greg Davis on tour in 2010. And I was like, well, this is it. This is what I want to do. And at the time, Greg was doing probably venues that were probably 800,000-900,000 seaters. A little bit more than that, probably.
Goodness.
That was on his first tour, and then they got bigger on the next tour. And I did 2 tours. And I remember thinking, if I can get to a point where I can do a tour where there's like a couple of hundred people in the audience everywhere I go, I'm going to be very, very happy. And I've done that and some more. So I've got to be happy with that. But
yeah,
that was in my mind what success was. And I never really thought about doing TV or anything like that.
Okay.
I just wanted to do live comedy.
Was that supporting tour, when you look back now, was that your big break?
Yeah, probably in my confidence and also, yeah, generally. I mean, not necessarily in the industry, because the support act means nothing, really.
Oh, really?
But for me to be able to do, you know, 60 gigs in a year with Greg was just invaluable. Yeah. And watching him every night as well, just be brilliant. So, yeah.
Being a support act is difficult because, you know, people aren't, not in a bad way, but people aren't there to see you.
Oh, no, absolutely.
A difficult role to play, because if people have paid a ticket to come and see you, you have this inner confidence because, you know, they obviously want to see you. But it must be quite a hard thing to go on stage to that kind of audience.
But then also you can think of it in the reverse, in that no one's expecting you to be there. So if you have a reasonably good gig, you've done amazingly.
Yeah, that's true.
And also you're there to do a job, and sometimes the job is to soak up the apathy in the room so the person can go on afterwards and have the gig of their lives. That's certainly what I tell my support acts.
Okay.
You're an apathy sponge.
Let's talk about the fifth Desert Island dish. What's the dish you eat the most often?
Oh, it's probably something really boring, though. Like, if you're talking most often, I mean, it's breakfast. It's probably like an omelette or fried eggs and bacon.
Okay. Is that how you start every day?
A lot of days, yeah. I go through phases with breakfast. You've got to keep it mixed, haven't you? But no, I go through big egg phases.
Okay.
And I love an omelette. Actually, I was at Mountain the other day, there was a spider crab omelette, which was incredible. But I'd also already had an omelette for breakfast, so double omelette day is not...
A spider crab omelette for breakfast would be quite punchy.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't do that. It was very seasoned as well. I think I would have felt dead for the rest of the day. I think eggs, just eggs, what a great go-to. How versatile. Don't know if anyone's ever spoken about the versatility of eggs before, but I'm here to...
You sound like you have a lot in common with the guy who came up with the slogan, like, go to work on an egg,
and I completely agree with that,
He wasn't wrong.
And also, you just feel like a bodybuilder when you're eating loads of eggs.
Yeah.
So you feel healthy, even though I'm sure there's huge health downsides to eating loads of eggs. But, yeah, an omelette, fantastic.
Do you have a certain technique?
No.
Okay.
Bung it in.
Yeah.
You can't be messing around in the morning. Just bung it in and get it in.
Even if it ends up more like scrambled egg.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
Again, who's looking?
Ketchup?
No, hot sauce. I have a selection of about 50 hot sauces
at home.
Oh, do you? Yeah. Some of them I buy because their names are funny, and then it turns out they're inedible.
Okay. So, like, what level of heat can you handle?
I like spicy stuff, and that wakes you up in the morning as well. I've never understood why... If you're having breakfast out somewhere in the UK, you have to ask for hot sauce, and they look really baffled. And then they'll go away and come back with a sort of trade-sized bottle of Tabasco. But in the States, when I spent time in the States, there's always hot sauce on the table, and that's what I like. But Nothing too much. Like, if I eat anything really spicy, I start to hiccup.
Oh, okay.
So if I start hiccuping, breakfast gone wrong.
What about those famous Doritos, the challenge with the really spicy ones? Have you done that?
Yeah, I've done that. I did that for...
Easy.
Me and James went to film a video for a sort of online, I don't know what you call them, network, Lad Bible. And we did like the sort of posh versus normal food, right? And that was fine. And then they went, oh, we want to do this thing. And they really snuck it up on us. They went, oh, you're going to try to do this one chip challenge thing. It's really funny when people do it. And we were like, oh, I'm not sure. They were like, yeah, it's really good. So we did that, and it's the most painful 3 hours I've had in my life.
3 hours?
It doesn't stop. It doesn't stop. It just keeps going.
Oh, my God. What, from one little bite?
Oh, well, no, we both had the whole thing.
Okay.
But you know they banned those in America now because a kid died.
No, like, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Someone died. It's not even, it's just the spice and the, it makes you panic and it has this huge physiological effect. Like, it was really bad. Like, I was chugging milk. And, well, I was just quiet. So we said don't release the video because it's really bad.
Yeah.
But I went really quiet and James swore at the crew for about an hour. Yeah.
No, we need to see that video.
You're never going to see it.
One day we will. You talk in the book about how losing weight changed how people saw you and also how they treated you, but that ultimately inside nothing had changed, both in terms, obviously, of who you are, but also how you think. This isn't something that we hear men talking about very often, and I wondered if you could tell us a little bit more about that experience.
In terms of how the change how people saw me?
Yeah,
I mean, you just sort of, I think when I was bigger, that was the first thing that people saw about me.
Mm.
And I always felt, and it might not have been them, but it might have just been my view of how society works. I felt like they were waiting for me to mention it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, to sort of almost break that seal and go, don't worry, guys, I know I'm fat, and make some joke about it. Whereas suddenly the confidence I had when I lost that weight was something I wasn't expecting. Like, and I felt more confident, but not because I thought I looked better necessarily, but because I thought other people thought I looked better. Yeah.
Reading the book was really interesting because it sort of felt like you don't believe that you look better now. You were like genuinely surprised by people's reactions and kind of annoyed that people would treat you differently when you are exactly the same person. And it's kind of... Or them being nice about you now is actually not them being nice about you now. It's being rude about how you were before.
Well, I think it's always that double-handed thing, isn't it, where if anyone loses weight or anyone does anything like that, people will go, God, you look great. It's like, well, what were you thinking before that? What, were you just walking around going, oh, God, Ed looks awful again?
Or what could he look like?
Yeah, and I get that thing of people want to bring it up when they feel like they have something to compliment you about, but it shouldn't be a compliment because, like I say in the book as well, you never know why someone's lost weight.
Yeah.
So it's probably always best to just think in your head, they look different, and then move on with your life because it really doesn't make that much difference to you.
But it's interesting to hear about how people did treat you differently after you lost weight.
Yeah.
Like, what does that say about our society?
Well, there you go.
I only have a small experience of that, but I put on a lot of weight when I was pregnant. And it is a really strange thing, like being in a different body and then seeing how people react to you. It's very discombobulating.
Yeah, and I lost that weight, and then I think I got an acting job almost immediately afterwards.
And so then what does that tell you internally?
Yeah. It tells you what you know about the acting world already.
Yeah. It's interesting.
Yeah.
In the book, you talk about the other side of being a stand-up, which you didn't sort of anticipate, which is the photo shoots and that whole public side of things, which obviously has to come hand in hand with it. But it is very image-focused. Do you think you would have got the opportunities that you got if you hadn't lost weight?
I'm not sure because I also don't know how losing weight affected the way I came across anyway, with the level of confidence and the sort of freedom to do other things. So maybe losing that weight made me a bit more confident and walk a bit taller. So that helps as well. I mean, it's a confidence game, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, perhaps I can't necessarily see myself doing all of the things that I've done if I hadn't lost that weight. But then also, as we've discussed, I wouldn't be a comedian if I wasn't a fat kid. Yeah. So
that's very interesting.
So I've done it the right way around.
Yeah, no, but I did, when I read it, I just thought it was so refreshing to hear a man talk about this kind of stuff, because I feel like these are quite female-focused conversations normally.
There's a huge issue with male body image, and men don't necessarily talk about it. And I think all the issues that are rightly raised with female body image and social media and all of that, that all exists for men as well.
Yeah.
But there's just not that much focus on it.
Yeah, it's true. Like every year with Love Island, the talk is always on the female contestants and the pressure and the rest of it. But it's the men are in
absolutely
the same position.
Yeah, I just want to see one guy go in there wearing a T-shirt.
I know.
That's
just
all
refusing
I want.
To take it off.
It's not, it, to me, it's it's not a relatable experience. Mm. They're all walking around in their trunks. Like me or none of my friends, I've never been on holiday with any of my friends where any of the men take their T-shirt off at any point.
It must be in the contract.
It must be.
What, do you wear a T-shirt to go swimming?
I have done. I don't anymore.
Yeah.
But I still have that thing where
to
I'm
like...
To
protect you from sunburn.
Yeah, exactly. And other people's eyes. I still have that thing where I'm like, oh, I don't like it. I don't like taking my T-shirt off and going for a swim. Or I'll do the thing of taking the T-shirt off and just running to the pool as quickly as possible, as if water obscures my body.
Yeah, we've all been there. We're on to the sixth desert island dish. What's your go-to dinner party dish?
So I talked about doing like slow cooking and all of that stuff. That tends to be what I do if people are coming over. So I'll spend all day, but I'll prepare it all in the morning, bung it in a pot, and then leave it for hours. So rarely have time for dinner parties. The last time I did a dinner party, I did beef cheeks. Slow cooked in Barolo wine and vegetables and onions and all that business, and did that for, it was like 5 hour cook, and it just filled, the smell fills the house with polenta. I did polenta as well, and never do dessert, never cook dessert for a dinner party.
Oh, okay.
No way.
No.
You're giving yourself too much to do.
Okay. And no. You haven't done a good enough job of filling them up with
exactly.
The main course.
Exactly. Or you tell them to bring dessert.
Okay.
That's the only way to do it. You pick something up from Marks and Spencer's.
Yeah. You're welcome to come, but you have to bring...
Yeah, bring a flan or something.
What about cheese? Because we have to talk about the cheese board. It's something I know you're very passionate about.
Hugely.
You're eager to spread the joy of the cheese board to the masses, and in doing so, make the world a better place.
Yeah.
That's your, like, political slogan.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm running for Mayor of London under that banner.
I mean, I think you'd get quite a lot of votes for that. So obviously, aside from cheese being the best thing in the whole world, what is it about the cheese board that you feel so passionate about?
I think there's few things where you get that amount of variety within one foodstuff and tastes. And it's the wine of food. Mm. I think there's so much to enjoy and so many different methods of producing it. And I think it's exciting. And I'm so boring. I like hearing about the cheese makers. Yeah. I like their stories. Yeah. But also, like, after a meal, I think now I'm less likely to get it after a meal because I'm doing such a good job on the starter and main.
Okay.
A cheese board is a meal in and of itself, I think.
Yeah,
I think
it's quite punchy to, like, pull out a really big one and then have to start all over again.
Yeah, I think now I'm more likely to be like, I'm just going to have cheese for dinner.
Mm.
That's my dream, really.
But I was interested that you think a cheese string has a place on a cheese board.
Yeah, because I think people are snobs as well.
Have you ever eaten a cheese string without pulling it?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You've got to
try.
It doesn't taste as good.
And it's not as fun, certainly. No. And I feel like you're not giving it its full potential. The cheese string's a wonderful invention. I think it's mad that people aren't all over this.
Mm.
Imagine a cheese board with just a little pile of strings in the corner. I think it's fantastic.
Well, I think it's because they're marketed to children, but that's where they're going wrong.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Like the sucky yogurts. Those are Fruits. Delicious.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah, but you also get the children's, it's just like a grown up yogurt, but in a sucky pouch. But
a sucky pouch.
I know. That is what they're called. They're called suckies.
Well, that's great for a start. That's not marketed at children at all.
Oh no, I'm never going to look at them the same way again. That's terrible. We need to write to them. That is bad. But yeah, well, something else. You've got a great description of cheeses ranked as though they were a football team, which I enjoyed very much. But I was surprised at your description of quince being on the subs bench and saying it's essentially useless. But Ed, did you really mean that?
Yeah, I do mean it. I think I feel that way about any chutneys on a cheese board, anything like that.
Really?
Yeah, I think they're there for sort of aesthetic purposes. I think they're there for, like, it's just not for me. If a cheese is good enough, you just need the cheese. Mm. Even crackers, like, sure, now and again, if I'm having it.
Oh, really?
As a standalone meal, I will just eat just the straight cheese, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, I think anything like quince, you like taking away from the flavour of the cheese.
Okay.
But, you know, each to their own.
Each to their own.
But I'm a purist.
Okay.
Yeah.
On Desert Island Dishes, we have a cookbook corner, so I'd love to know, what is your most treasured cookbook?
So, as I say, I tend to just read them like novels. I don't think there's many cookbooks that I've cooked more than three things from.
Okay.
I have ones with recipes in that I keep going back to, so I essentially keep like a whole 500-page book for one page of it. So there's a couple that I'll bring up. The Pit Q cookbook, which, like, I'm a massive barbecue fan, so if it's an, I'd rather just get rid of the oven inside and only use the barbecue forever, really.
Okay, you can
but
do that.
Yeah, I could, but I don't think my wife would be very happy about that, because also when I barbecue, I cook enough for 50 or 60 people.
How could she be sad about that?
Well, yeah, but the fridge is full of sort of leftover burnt sausages and stuff. But Pit Q is like proper American barbecue, but they've actually got a recipe in there for these pickled shiitake mushrooms, which is something I go back to all the time. We've normally got a jar of them in the fridge.
Oh, wow.
Where they use dry mushrooms and then rehydrate them. And then, yeah, you pickle them and with like soy sauce in there as well and star anise, and then put them in the fridge, and then they last for ages. Yum. And they go with everything. They go very well with cheese, actually.
Oh, now you've changed your tune.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so quince is out.
I don't believe that was the tune I was singing, you know? I don't think pickled shiitake mushrooms was a verse in the chutney song.
Well, no, I just don't know why you were giving quince such a hard time.
Well, I still am. It's nothing compared to that. So that book, definitely. But I'll tell you the book I'm going to bring, because I just started properly going through it the other day, is Andy Oliver's new book, The Pepper Pot Diaries, which is incredible, and I'm genuinely going to cook stuff from that. So I've already earmarked the curry goat and roti from that to me.
Yeah,
and also I work with Andy a lot, and I'd love to be able to go in and go, I cooked this from your book.
You could bring it in.
Yeah.
No.
She,
why not?
She would tell me if she didn't like
it. Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, that's high stakes.
Yeah.
Would, obviously, your debut book is about to come out. Would you ever think about a cookbook?
I would, but I'd feel a bit of a hypocrite because I don't cook enough. Mm. So I think I'd have to maybe go on a... And this is the sort of thing I'd do, take 3 years off comedy to just cook all the time and then write a cookbook.
Do you think that is something that you do?
Well, it's the sort of thing I'd say to my wife. I'd go, I'm going to take 3 years off comedy and write a cookbook. She'd go, you're having a breakdown.
Okay. Like, is that kind of what happened during lockdown?
Yeah, I mean, I got obsessed with barbecues then. I was barbecuing 5 or 6 times a week. And okay. I thought I was having the best time of my life. And I was genuinely in my head like, this, God, I love this. I mean, look, it's awful that there's a pandemic, but so great. I'm absolutely loving this. And then my wife sent me a picture of me, and I was stood outside it at nighttime, only lit by the flames of a barbecue, wearing pajamas. And I was like, no, this is an episode.
This has gone too far. Yeah, but it's weird when you're in it, something like that, and you do genuinely feel very happy.
I was on top of the world.
So at the end of this podcast, we are going to send you off to a desert island. How does the thought of being sent to a desert island make you feel?
I mean, at the moment, I'm quite busy, so it does sound lovely. Okay. It depends what sort of facilities are available on the desert island.
I think it's very bare.
Mm. No, I mean, I've taken Andy's book, haven't I?
Yep.
So I'll read that and then see what happens.
Are you good in your own company?
I think I'm good in my own company, but there's a threshold.
Okay.
So sometimes when I go away for work and it's just me, I'll be like sitting in a hotel room or whatever and thinking, this is great. I love being by myself. And then after like a day or two, I've gone mad and I need to see some people. So I'd probably last 24 hours on the desert island before I start getting angry.
Okay. The countdown is on.
Yeah.
We're on to the final 7th desert island dish. What is the last dish you choose to eat before being sent to the desert island?
I love Turkish food. Mm. So I'd probably go with like a huge like feast, a Turkish feast, and go with all of the cold starters, the hummus and all of that gang, the baba ganoush gang, like amazing breads, the pita and then also the, I think it's lakmakun. I think that's how you say it. Apologies if you're Turkish. It's like the almost pizza sort of thing, but with like a very thin layer of tomato and lamb.
Yeah.
Love a bit of that. Halloumi, yes, please. all of that stuff. The sucuk, which is the sausage, like the spicy Turkish sausage, throw that on the starters as well. And then just a pile of grilled meat, like the Adana kebab and lamb shish and chicken shish and baiti and all of that piled on.
So good. What are you drinking?
I mean, what goes with that really is probably some beer, but if I'm eating that much, I don't want to add the gas, you know?
Yeah.
So probably wine, probably like a magnum of Riesling.
Okay. I mean, don't worry about gas. You're going to be on your own on a desert island.
Yeah, I suppose it's quite entertaining to be by yourself with gas. Maybe if it gets really bad, I can sort of motorboat my way back. So that's a good idea, actually. my drink's going to be a pint of beans, please.
So no pudding, just a big tin of beans.
Yeah,
we'll send you
and then
on
I'll
your
just
way.
Get straight in the sea, and then I'll be back in 20 minutes.
Yeah, 24 hours.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
That's never going to happen. Ed Gamble, those are your desert island dishes. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
So there we have it, another delicious day of Desert Island Dishes. Don't forget that you can rate, review and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or wherever you're listening, I think, really. Very, very boring that podcasters always ask you to do this, but by leaving a review, it really does boost the show in the charts, and that means that wherever you're listening, it shows it to other people, more people listen, and that means I can keep bringing it to you each week. So that's a very roundabout way of asking you to leave a review, but thank you very much. If you don't already, then come and follow me on Instagram at Desert Island Dishes. And of course, you can sign up for the newsletter and also find a whole host of different recipes at desertislanddishes.co. Thank you so much for listening. I'll see you next week. Bye.